Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Earthon Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters, and the questers of Josh and Dan. I am Dan.
I am Josh.
And on today's podcast, we will be discussing all things Arrowentical and Quizzical, but not in that order, because we're going to talk about some emails, and then we're going to get to Asante and Night Sky, the paired dragons out of the Dragon Source book. But until then, you have to wait for that because we're going to get to some emails. But Josh has a comment to bring up first about our third to last episode with Aban. So go way back in the time machine.
1, 2, 3 weeks ago, as of the release of this episode, we were talking about the great dragon Aban, aka Mistweaver, aka the dragon that lairs in the mist swamps. Yes. That was the episode where we were very nearly done recording when Dan's internet went out.
Yeah, totally.
And so we didn't get to wrap up the episode that we normally, the way we normally do. Dan added on a thing at the end and brought up the notion that perhaps the reason that Aban was always dark was because she was in mourning for Cloud Tamer, which is not a bad idea.
Just occurred to me.
I had a thought as well, post-recording, while kind of going through the episode and going, oh, and listening to that part where we were talking about the color, I wonder if it's this. And that is, if you will recall, or if you don't recall because maybe you didn't know, but I am about to enlighten you. The various colored dragons in Dungeons & Dragons typically were associated with a particular environment. And black dragons are typically associated with swamps and marshes.
Interesting.
And green dragons, if you want to talk about fast green, are typically associated with forests and jungles.
Jungles. That just makes sense. It's camouflage.
Hence, we've got fast green.
Yes.
White dragons, although we haven't actually talked about Icewing, so we'll have to check when we get to that, but white dragons are typically associated with icy conditions and snow and frost. We'll have to see if Icewing, whose primary lair is on top of Mount Vapor, is sort of white in color or not. This might be like a sheer coincidence. This might be something where in a couple of cases, they found a way to kind of give homage to the classic color association tropes. So that was the thought that occurred to me.
No, fair. I think both of them are not bad. I like both of those. So that works. So if you have any questions for us about Aban or dragon camouflage and coloring systems, please drop us a line. We love email because we're going to start some email here in just a quick sec. So the email address again is edsgpodcast@gmail.com. This one's from Rasmus. Hi again. Yet another thanks to you for a great podcast and infinite patience with my questions. You are simply the best, taking all this time answering my questions and ascertaining my doubts. So when are you making an episode entirely dedicated to Alakia?
We did a Bloodwood episode where I talked about Alakia quite a bit.
If that's not enough Alakia.
I probably talked about Alakia quite a bit in the history episode we did way back where we were talking about the Bloodwood. I think any time that the Bloodwood comes up on the show, I end up talking about Alakia a whole bunch.
Kind of hard not to.
I don't know that we will actually at this point need to do a full episode devoted to Alakia. Although, now that I think about it, we are going to be going through and covering the material in Secret Societies of Barsave, and I'm pretty sure one of the chapters in there is the Songbirds.
Yeah.
Which is Alakia's intelligence network. So we will probably be talking about her
yet again.
Bit more. But look, if you want to hear me talk about Alakia, join the FASA Discord and bring up stuff about Alakia, preferably during a time when I'm actually able to devote attention to it. So that would be kind of like evenings during the week, Eastern U.S. Standard Time or Daylight Time or whatever, like East Coast Time.
Yeah.
Or on the weekends, because I will get in trouble at work if I get drawn away to doing Discord on my phone when I should be answering calls from clients.
Yeah, there's that. So next question. Can you use more than one mask at a time? Or would that give design issues regarding challenge ratings and other stuff?
You can. It does kind of eventually run into the same kind of issues that you have with using masks in the first place, where you are potentially bumping up the effective tier of the creature. If you bump it up from, you know, novice to journeyman or journeyman to warden or whatever. I'm not a huge fan of it, but it is certainly something that you could do. I mean, I say I'm not a huge fan of it, but I wrote an adventure for Gen Con one year that had the scene was titled The Obligatory Sewer Level, that involved a giant corrupted alligator or something. So I was like slapping two or three masks on top of a creature.
There you go.
But yeah, you can do it. It's not something that I've had any actual discussions with Morgan about or seen any kind of guidance or anything from Morgan, who was pretty heavily involved in designing that system.
Yeah.
In terms of, no, you should only use one mask at a time. Obviously, you probably only need to use one mask from a particular category at a time. You don't want to stack like two large templates. You might as well just go up to the giant or whatever the category options are. That's why there are sort of different gradations of masks that you can add on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As long as you are paying attention to what the final numbers end up being and that they are still an appropriate obstacle or challenge based on what you need for the scene for your player character group, it's probably fine.
Yeah, fair enough. Third question. Have you any thought on a fix to avoid blow? If the attack roll against you is high, it makes more sense not to dodge and thus avoid taking a strain. That is thematically a little sad, I think. Instead of an all or nothing, a partly successful avoid blow could reduce the excess successes from your opponent's attack or something like that.
I've heard that. I have not given it a whole lot of thought, and I don't see that as being something that we are likely to redesign in terms of the base talent. It might be something worth exploring possibly as a knack to make that as an option, if that's something that you would perhaps want to try.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would need to think about where the default difficulty numbers and stuff. Would you be basically rolling a void blow against your own defense at that point and canceling success for success? Are you taking the result of your avoid blow and just subtracting it from the result? Like, I would really need to think about how the mechanics of that would work, because a void blow as it is sets the default target number at the attack test result. And obviously, if you want to have some kind of reduction factor in there, then you need to figure out what your base target number is and how that's going to interact with things.
Yeah.
It's not something that we have considered. It might be possible space to develop a knack, but I don't know off the top of my head how exactly that might work or whether that's something that is actually worth exploring.
Yeah.
We already fixed avoid blow by getting rid of the fact that if you fail, you get knocked down automatically.
Yes. So I think avoid blow is like 95% workable just fine for the nitpicky things here and there, whatever.
I do understand the annoyance that if you get hit really, really well, that it's really, really hard to avoid and you want to get some use out of the talent. Yeah, I can understand that. But sometimes stuff just doesn't work.
Yeah, it's hard to quantify, you know, real life physics and action into dice rolls and numbers. So
I'm not even getting into that. I'm just understanding it from a gameplay perspective of, oh, I have this tool, but in these circumstances, this tool is not useful. Sometimes that's the way things work.
Yeah, it's kind of like you take a hammer to fix a car. It's not going to work. You need wrenches and things. Yeah.
Yeah. It's more that such things would also require looking at steel thought and resistant
similar talents. Yeah.
And other similar talents and seeing if, again, that's why I think that if it's something that you really want to explore, a knack might be the best way to go.
Yeah, fair. Don't just overhaul the entire thing. Just tweak this little tiny part and call it done. Group pattern allows for 5 individual threads to be woven. Do those count as one item? You have one item representing your role within the group. Or does it count as 5 different threads and thus actually limit the usefulness as you then block access to other threads from items and other sources?
It's the latter. Each thread that you weave to a group pattern item counts separately against your thread limit.
Okay. Asked and answered. One for Josh, because so far none of these have been for me. So... release schedule for Legends of Earthdawn. Only 2 episodes has been released in 2021, and we are in the middle of a big showdown.
Oh,
that's Cliff.
I don't know, man. Talk to Cliff.
Yeah. Sorry. Email Cliff. We don't have any control over it. I've offered to, you know, put some episodes together for him if the editing is the problem, but, you know, I don't think Cliff's listening.
I know that we are still playing. And so the backlog of episodes that have been recorded continues to grow.
Yeah.
But in terms of getting them out the door, my involvement in that show is showing up to play when we are scheduled to play. Yes. I am not involved in any of the post-production on that.
Sorry. I've offered Cliff. If Cliff is listening in any way, shape, or form, I have offered my editing services to see if I can help push those out, because I as well would like to hear some. But that's just me. Also, mostly for Josh, yet again, none for me, release schedule for new books. We want more stuff. So when will the next book hit Kickstarter? Asked and answered.
The next book is actually on Kickstarter right now with only like 3 days left. So if you were not aware of it and you have not backed it, you are almost out of time.
Yeah, you're in deep kimchi.
What is the date that this episode is dropping? The Kickstarter ends November 19th, 2021 for Vasgothia.
Yeah.
This episode is scheduled to drop on the 17th.
48 hours.
You've got a little bit more than 40, depending on when you hear this episode.
I'm going 40.
There is not much time left. So it's happening now. This email was sent to us before the Kickstarter launched. I think before we actually had even announced it.
Fair.
I mentioned, and you've probably heard, Rasmus, if you listened to our Vasgothia Kickstarter special a couple of weeks ago.
And or the last episode where we mentioned it as well.
Yeah. That one of the things that we discussed was where things are. We're hoping to get a Kickstarter done, another Earth Dawn Kickstarter done after the Vasgothia one sometime in the early part of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the changes that we had with our printer, the printer that we had been using for all of our books prior to Vasgothia.
Yeah.
So up through Empty Thrones. Part of the reason that it took so long for Empty Thrones to get out was that the printer that we had been using and had used for basically everything up to that point ran into some issues. And so we've changed printers, and it has meant that we have a little bit longer lead time from delivering the book to the printer to actually get the physical books in hand. And so if we want to have books at Gen Con, we need to actually have books like done and submitted to the printer by like early April. Gotcha. Vasgothia and Champions Challenge Volume 2 should hit that no problem. So after the Earthdawn campaign ends, there's like a couple of other Kickstarters that are planned for other game lines that are going to be launching like right after the other. We've got a whole slew of stuff that's on its way.
So 2022 is the year.
Some 1879 stuff is going to be seeing Kickstarter.
Yeah.
We're hoping to get, no promises, but we're hoping to get Grand Bazaar, Magic Deeper Secrets out kickstarted first half-ish of next year of 2022. We will see what happens with those.
Josh, shut up.
Fingers crossed.
Shut up and take my money. Just take my money. That's it. Just, yeah.
You want me to actually give you something in return for it?
No, just take my money. Just get them made.
Take your money.
Just get them made. Personally, I'm most interested in the new rules like the Deeper Magic book and books focusing on Bar Save, as that is where we play. I will buy the Theron books for sure, but they are just not as interesting for me, at least. All the best wishes for your health. And again, thank you for a great podcast, Rasmus. So
Vasgothia is the book that's being kickstarted right now because it's the book that's done. Grand Bazaar is focused on Thrall and the Grand Bazaar of Thrall. So that is very definitely of interest to somebody who has more of a Barsabian focused game.
Totally.
Deeper Secrets, obviously, when that's done, is going to be of interest to anybody and everybody.
I can imagine the stretch goals in that one because everybody's been waiting for that book.
And I really need to get Kraken on Europa.
Fair. All right. Next up is Sebastian with a really quick one, just because he wanted to give Lars a shout out for his awesome work on the Steps character sheet. It's his birthday today, whenever he sent this in, and wanted to let him know how much he and others, many others, appreciate the work Lars has put into the Steps character creator. P.S. The Europa book when?
When it's done.
Eventually, how's that?
Yeah, eventually. I'm not going to get into that anymore.
No,
right now.
No. Can't make any promises. We've got two more. Some longer emails here from Alan. First up. Hello,
with a U. Hello, Josh and Dan. I love the show, and I always find your insights into Earthon thought-provoking. Let's get right to it. Why in the name of Alakia does raising an attribute cost silver? You're killing us out here. I wanted to increase the strength of my weaponsmith one measly point, and the GM says it costs silver. Silver! What am I paying for? A gym membership? I reckoned an attribute was something that was just reached through careful adventuring and natural character growth. What if I am raising charisma? Who gets paid for that? And a makeup artist? Speechwriter? Everything in Earthon cost silver. I get it. Give us poor blokes a break. Also, one of the fellows in the Marathon group is a windling shaman. He gets astral sight as a racial trait, but also gets it as a second circle as a shaman. What gives? Are they both the same? Do they stack? Is he doubly kick-ass in astral sight? Does one show astral space in green and the other in purple? Explain it to me like I'm a fifth grader. No, third grader. Thanks. Love you guys. Keep up the good work. Alan.
Okay, so there are two questions there.
Well, I'm not sure they were really questions other than what gives, but...
There are two topics there. The first of them is attribute increases. The silver cost is something that was a legacy from previous editions. I don't think that first edition... Damn it.
I want to say they did.
My first edition book. Hold on.
I really want to say they did.
I don't remember whether first edition had silver costs for... first edition, you see, had something a little bit different. First edition tied attribute advancement to circle advancement. You could only do one attribute increase per circle. And it was never completely clear whether that was something that you had to do before you advanced or you did it when you advanced and what the restrictions on that were.
Yeah.
So I'm not completely convinced that it was something that was in first edition. Let's see. Building your legend, first edition book, improving attributes. Yeah, first edition just had the legend point cost. First edition did not have silver cost.
Yeah.
I don't have the second edition book right to hand. I know it was something that was introduced.
Player's compendium. The table of contents is huge.
Building your legend. So in Earthdawn Classic.
Yeah.
The silver cost and training time for improving attributes was introduced. And this was because attribute increases were decoupled from circle advancement. Mm-hmm. And so it was a mechanic that was put in place to kind of limit circle advancement in terms of just how much time that it took. So it was something that was introduced there and obviously stayed in third edition and kept in fourth. So it's largely a legacy thing. If silver is a problem, then a couple of suggestions for that. One, your game master should be giving you more money.
Fair.
Whether payments for tasks that you were doing for people or finding more treasure or whatever.
Tell them Josh told you so.
I understand in some respects maybe the desire for a game master to keep their player characters lean and hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard stories. There's a guy on the Discord, or there's a running joke on the FASA Discord about there's a group that apparently does all sorts of stuff and never gets paid for any of the jobs that they do. But I largely think that once you get out of your first three or four circles, silver should be less of a concern. But that's my personal style. I have thought about ways of actually getting rid of the need to track individual coinage in Earthdawn. There's a system that is used in the revamps of the Trinity games where wealth is just a rating and it kind of determines what you can get with stuff.
Hmm.
And introducing something like that. But
yeah,
unless it's intentionally something that's part of the game, I'm not a big fan of keeping money out of the hands of my player characters. Like, I want them to have enough money to do the stuff that they want. So if they, like, obviously, training circles, obviously, if they want to increase attributes, I want them to have the money to do that. Obviously, money to buy supplies and stay at inns and, like, buy upgraded armor and to pay for forging. And, like, there's plenty of stuff that money can be spent on. Give it to them. That's my opinion on that.
Fair. No, I'm good. Yeah. Hit it.
So that's the money situation. Second, windlings. Racial astral sight and getting astral sight as a talent from a discipline. Yes. I forget offhand whether astral sight is a discipline talent for shaman. I've got mystic paths still open here.
I want to say it is.
I've just got to scroll back in the PDF. It is discipline talent for Shaman at Second Circle.
Yeah.
So it is the same. Functionally, in 4th edition, it is the same talent, which means that there is not really any point in the Windling spending legend to increase the rank of their racial astral sight ability.
Agreed.
Because they get it as a talent, so they might as well just wait until they reach Second Circle and start buying it up then. They can still default to straight perception for it. That is something that is clarified in the errata, that Windlings mm-hmm. can use astral sight effectively at rank zero with just a straight perception test. But yeah, they're the same thing. If you want to be classically purist about it, there is supposedly a difference between the information and detail that is available to the Windling's native astral sight as compared to the talent astral sight. That's a difference without a distinction as far as the mechanics goes, and is something that was kind of eliminated in 3rd edition, I think, if not in classic. Yeah, there are some disciplines, Nethermancer is another one, where you'll get discipline talent access to astral sight when you have it as a racial ability as a Windling. Don't waste the points to put it into the racial ability, because then you just need to spend them again to advance it as a talent.
Yeah.
If it's available as an option,
yeah,
then maybe you want to take a different option and take advantage of the fact that you've got the racial ability, which I think costs the same to increase. You just don't have the ability to spend karma on it, which is probably fine for astral sight once you get a few ranks in it.
Yeah. Not a whole lot to worry about there. Great. Thank you, Alan. And I love the way you styled that question. So that was awesome. Keep them coming. We like those. Next, last one. Hello, Josh and Dan. I just started playing a Windling Weaponsmith. I am still trying to figure out what type of character he wants to be. So I've really been enjoying your podcast on questers and paths, which means I now want him to be 4 different questers with about 5 different paths. But seriously, you have made them all sound so good.
We are doing our job correctly then. Thank you.
Agreed. So it is very hard to figure which one I want to go after. Now on to my questions. 1, if you have a talent from your discipline and you pick up a path that has the same talent, is there any way to pick up that talent in your path to free up the talent option slot for your discipline? The reason I am asking is there is a talent speak language that I've already picked up as it goes very well with my character background. I was really torn because I wanted to pick up disarm traps, since my group does not have a thief. It would be great if I could, when I get into paths, to be able to swap that talent with a talent slot in the path and then pick up disarm trap as an optional talent.
That's a complicated question.
It's a simple question with a complicated answer.
Complicated presentation, yeah, okay.
Rules as written?
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not something that's technically allowed. As a GM myself, if you came to me with that concern mm-hmm. when it came to your character advancement, and I don't think disarm trap is available as an option to any of the paths. It certainly hasn't been as any of the paths that we've covered thus far. Pretty sure it's not available.
Yeah.
Like my initial reaction, setting aside specifics, my initial reaction is for most paths, you've got like 10 choices for your first 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's probably another option that you would want to take. But in this particular case, it's I want to take this talent that is not available to whatever path I end up going.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get access to this ability as a talent, as opposed to, say, learning disarm trap as a skill, which does have the limitation of it's only effective on physical traps as opposed to magical ones as well.
And no karma.
Backing up, that being said, technically, rules as written, I don't think that that is something that is technically feasible.
Yeah.
However, me as a game master, if you came to me as one of my players and said, hey, here's the situation, this is something that I feel is lacking. First off, my thought as a GM is if you have a group that doesn't have access to disarm trap, unless mm-hmm. you've discussed this beforehand, why are you putting them into situations where that's something that they would need to have or feel that they need to have?
Yeah.
But that's a completely separate conversation.
Totally.
I'm sidebarring myself so much on this. It's awful. If you came to me as your player and said, hey, I want to pick this up, but it's not available in the path, but one of the options that I already have is available as one of my past talents, is it okay if I swap this out and pick up Disarm Trap as my optional talent under my discipline? I would probably let you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an optional talent, so it's not likely to be interfering with your actual discipline advancement or anything like that.
Yeah.
I would probably allow it. I am, generally speaking, a fan of allowing characters to be tweaked or adjusted to better fit with what a character might like, or, you know, what the player might like for their character.
Yeah. As long as it befits the story, yeah.
Personally, as a GM, I would try to find a way to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I come back to the what's going on in your game that you feel you need to have disarm trap. Is it just because you don't have a thief and you want to have that ability just in case it becomes important? Well, you come to me as a GM with that concern, it would be, hey, I know you guys don't have this ability. I'm not likely to put you in a situation where this is going to be super critical.
Yeah, or frequent.
Depending on what's going on, obviously there might be situations where there would be traps and so forth. But, you know, this is a meta game discussion about what's going on and what kind of obstacles we might be facing and the style of game that we're going to have. But ultimately, fair. Yeah, if you want to kind of make this change to fit something that fits your concept of the character better or whatever, I'd work with you. I'd find a way to make it work.
Yeah, I'm all for
it. It's just not technically rules as written.
Yeah,
legal.
I'm all for let's find the character you want to play and make that happen within reason.
I think this is completely reasonable.
Totally.
You are going to be predetermining or sacrificing or having one of your path selections be a talent that you already have to open up a slot. You could even justify it in a similar kind of way of somebody who is picking up a second discipline who happens to have a discipline talent that is one of your optionals. And I mm-hmm. think that theoretically opens up the option slot as well. I don't see any particular reason why you couldn't sort of realign things. Yeah, I think it's workable. I think it's fine.
Yeah, cool. Number two and last. Could you have a scholar that ever goes into the library? One who is very driven to find the truth of things but doesn't like to learn from a book. One who likes to learn from personal experience. Or would that character be better served as a quester of Minbruges? Thanks for all your work, Matthew.
The character would probably be better served as a questor of Minbruges. I mean, obviously, within the framework of the particular version of Barsave that your game master has set things in, they're free to allow stuff in whatever sense. But part of the conceptualization of the scholar path is that they are going to be heavily involved within academic circles. And even if they might not be super into working in libraries themselves, it sounds to me like it's more about the exploration of the truth, which is much more a Minbruges thing than it is the collective accumulation of knowledge and learning, which is related, but has that academic hierarchical library structure all kind of wrapped up in it.
Yeah.
What kind of framework is going to be put in place for the path that is going to allow this to be a thing? Or what kind of obstacles is the player character going to be facing as part of the fact that they kind of don't like to deal with it, which could be a fascinating and interesting story. But again, going back to the idea of I want you to play the character that you want to play and maybe trying to find a way for that to work if it's something that you've really got your heart set on.
That brings us to the end of All Things Quizzical. And the beginning of the rest of the episode, All Things Aromantical, as we discuss Asante and Night Sky. The mated pair. This is an interesting set of characters in the game. Admittedly, over the last 25 years, I've rarely come across anything that mentioned Asante and Night Sky. So this was kind of a new read for me as I'm refreshing myself with all of these things. And they're not mentioned a lot. But they,
in fact, their first mention was in the original draft of the Dragon Sourcebook.
Yeah. So
they had not, as far as I'm aware, been mentioned previously.
I couldn't find them. This was my first dip into the, and I love the fact that this is yet another just aspect of dragon culture that is presented so nicely that it's so different from all the dragons that we've talked about so far are so individually different from everything else that credit to whoever created all of these beautifully done job on all the dragons. Because these Asante and Night Sky are not great dragons. They're merely adult dragons.
Yeah. Like Charcoal Grin.
Yeah, like Charklokrin. And they layer in the Kukhavik Mountains, the northern valley, so way up kind of near Parlanth a little bit, more so than most, actually. And per Outcast's description, they're Asante and Night Sky, both rebellious, immature, and naive. But then again, that's just maybe a little ageism on his part, just to go, oh, they're youngins, they don't know squat, so whatever. But the fact that Night Sky and Asante are just like salt and pepper, and I mean that is one's very dark and one's very light. One is literally black scales with tips on the ends of them, silver tips on the ends of all of his scales, making him look like a night sky with stars. And then Asante is cream white scales and horns and so forth. So it's just they're physically diametrically opposed, one male, one female, one black, one white. But the fact that they have bonded together, which is something unusual for dragons to do, is to quote-unquote mate for life. And they're doing that. So it's I love the fact that this is, again, kind of breaking the mold on what we expect dragons to be. And Asante and Night Sky have done that yet again. All the dragons we've so far talked about have broken the mold of what you think dragons would be and should be. Because in Earthdawn, they're all individually motivated characters, but these two, I think, just kind of take that right to a different level. Your initial thoughts?
This pair is interesting. They are the youngest or among the youngest adult dragons in Barsave. In fact, Night Sky is called out as the youngest adult dragon.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that we get an insight into, or an opportunity to kind of get hooks into not great dragons, like to deal with adults and to get another example. Like we've got Charklokrin as one example of a non-great adult dragon, but Charklokrin's got her own thing. Like she's Parlanth's dragon.
Yes.
Asante and Night Sky, the two of them, are another example and another breaking of the mold, like you said. Each of these dragons that we have been talking about is a character and in some ways typifies and in other ways goes against the standards of what the popular expectation of dragons are. And this is yet another example. We get sort of in the context of the Dragon's Book as a whole, the first half of the book is all about dragon life cycle and ritual and society and culture and all of these things. And bang, here in the examples we get, and here's a pair of young adult dragons that are breaking the mold and going against tradition. And
yes,
isn't that interesting? You know, whether this is laying the seed for a future plot line that the first edition development crew had in mind, or whether it was another case of, this is an interesting idea, let's toss this in here so that we've got it in the future if we want to.
Yeah.
It's just like another example of things and another way that we can make a twist and people can pick it up or ignore it as they wish.
Yeah. So how do you want to do the rest of this? I think we talk about one dragon at a time and then talk about them as a mated pair at the end so we can kind of just separate them out a little bit. So let's go with Night Sky first, because he was raised, so he actually emerged from his astral sleep 2 years before Thrall entered the Long Night. So he's like the youngest.
Yeah. He has only been an adult for 500 years, 400 or 500 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is interesting. Really,
not a long time for dragons, per se.
Not a long time for dragons, not a long time for adult dragons, but it's also the timing is very awkward for him as an individual, because he emerged, he became an adult basically just before the Scourge started.
Hey, I'm here. Crap. Now I have to go into hiding.
Yeah. And so did not have the appropriate time to prepare his own lair, and thus as a result had to find shelter with
Usun.
No, Usun raised him. He found shelter with Earthroot.
I'm sorry. You are correct.
He was raised by Usun. Took shelter with Earthroot during the Scourge. He is actually, for such a young dragon, he is actually large.
Yeah. He's a big boy.
but he wanted to be out in the world and has spent the first, you know, two-thirds or more of his adult life cooped up.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Gen Z dragon. The world situation has been rough and he has not been able to go out and spread his wings. Ha ha.
Yep.
And that is something that I think is a big insight into him temperamentally in Agreed. Terms of how he views things. I think that there is, both as a result of his youth, but also because of the circumstances of his early adulthood, that has kind of instilled in him an impatience that is atypical of dragons. Yeah. I don't know if that's something that's in the essay, but that strikes me as something that would be the case. You know, taking shelter under the Thrall Mountains with Earthroot during the Scourge and probably mm-hmm. wanting to be like, man, when can I go out? I want to go out. And Earthroot telling me, no, you cannot go out.
Yes.
It's dangerous.
No, you're not wrong. It was, I can't say explicitly laid out in the essay, but it was at least hinted at that, yes, he emerged from his astral cocoon, ready to take on the world. And then the Scourge happened. And it was one of those that like, they put a complete damper on his plans. So A, that kind of aids his mean, nasty kind of persona, which is, you know, just angry at everything. So Gen Z.
Now, look.
I'm teasing.
I was kind of making that commentary in the framework of the current, like, socioeconomic situation of those unfortunates.
Oh, yes.
Who do not, barring some kind of radical overhaul of our economic system here in the United States.
Yeah.
Have it tough, you know, mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah. No.
I'm not a Gen Xer who is like, oh, those stupid kids with their avocado toast nonsense. I'm just trying to cast that in the sense of we've got the great dragons who have had millennia.
Yes.
Portions of it in hibernation, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But who have had a really long time to get used to the long view and whatnot. And someone who is just hitting their adulthood and basically needing to delay their arrival into adulthood in a sense mm-hmm. because of circumstances beyond their control.
Totally. No, I was teasing. I'm just teasing.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just teasing.
Yeah. I don't want to condone generational bullshit like that, man.
No. No, I...
Anyway, all that aside, his Fair. Impatience did come into play by the fact that basically as soon as he was able to, mm-hmm. Night Sky left the protection of Earthroot's lair.
Absolutely.
And is... one of the first sentient individuals, sapient individuals to go out and look upon the world in the wake of the Scourge.
In fact, during that first excursion out where he was, you know, just surveying the area and seeing how things were and so forth and so on, he actually encountered and assisted the Earth Dawn itself.
At least according to the essay, that is true.
It's according to the essay, and that's from Outcast. And, you know, Outcast does have reason to lie, but I don't think he would actually deny a true event that took place.
Sure. I mean, the Outcast does potentially have reason to lie or misdirect, but the information that he presents in support of that is from an interview that Mountain Shadow did of mm-hmm. Night Sky and Night Sky's experiences.
Yeah.
And so there is no reason necessarily to doubt the veracity of that. No. And I think this is one of those like kind of neat little Easter egg kind of mm-hmm. things.
I loved it. I was just like, yeah, nice way to bring the Earth Dawn back into this thing with the youngest dragon that there is, who's never been mentioned before in any of the other material. So yeah, why not tie that in together? And
it is clarified. If you're looking at the essay, the Outcast does not reveal it. Mountain Shadow reveals it in his commentary where he says, oh yeah, I remember that. And the thing that he doesn't say is that this was in fact the Earth Dawn, and the troll that's described there is Ver Longfang, the captain of the Earth Dawn.
Yes. So, and because...
One other thing, talking about the Earth Dawn, because I'm like, I've got the old PDF up here. Mountain Shadow also reveals that Night Sky said that he had encountered the Earth Dawn again later, far from Barsave,
yes,
and still airborne and whatnot.
Yeah, but kind of like limping along with all the repairs.
Limping along and so forth. And I think this is one of those hooks Because remember, we've kind of had discussions about how there were some ideas of perhaps the Earth Dawn returning to Barsave at some, possibly in conjunction with the events of the original plans for Barsave at War, possibly as some kind of later thing, but that this is one of those hooks, particularly this late in the development cycle of first edition, that no, the Earth Dawn is potentially still out there to allow them the possibility of it actually returning.
Yes. But I'm glad that Night Sky was able to help out the Earth Dawn, because he is particularly fearsome in combat. A, he's, again, as we said, a big boy for his age. And B, he was raised by Usun. So, duh, he's going to look at things in a physical light and be very adept at combat. So I don't think that's a bad thing.
And also the fact that by traveling out in the very early post-Scourge world, ran into a lot of situations where his physical prowess was something that was going to be necessary to deal with the hazards of the horrors that were remaining and things like that.
Yeah, he took care of a couple of horrors. I mean, he fended off a horror from the Earth Dawn itself, so he was helpful in that regard. So I don't think he has any enmity toward the Namegiver races.
I wonder if the... It's not specifically given a description, but I have this image reading the section of the commentary, section of the bit of Night Sky's description, whether the horrors that were attacking the Earth Dawn were Rakan.
Oh, yeah. I had...
It just says that they were a pair of massive flying horrors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that there was fire involved.
Yeah.
That would be kind of cool. The idea that it was Rakan that he helped drive off in that initial encounter.
No, I had something along those lines, but didn't have the name for them. So I think you're right. I agree with you. I think they were Rakan entirely. So let's set him aside for a minute or so, because I think Night Sky is a fascinating character. Let's talk about Asante, because she's a complete, I can't say diametrically opposed, but almost so in every way. As I said, he's black with silver tips on his scales and claws, and she has cream white scales. So not like paper white, but cream, well done cream. She, in fact, is not just, 450, 500 years old. She's 800 years old. So she's older than him by a good 350, 400 years or so. I mean, we're not going to...
Still young, as dragons are reckoned.
Yes. But she feels compassion for the younger races. We don't necessarily know about Night Sky, but I don't think he's ambivalent or has any arrogance or anger toward the younger races. He's just there. But she actually feels compassion for the younger races. She gives her resources to Namegivers, who are usually victims of horrors in certain areas. But she was raised by Redwing in the Kokhavik Mountains. And Redwing also has not been previously mentioned that I can recall. But Josh's steel trap memory is better than mine any day of the week. So
Redwing is not counted among the great dragons of Barsave. And I'm kind of scanning through the chapter here, and I'm not sure whether that's because Redwing is no longer with us.
Redwing is no longer with us.
Okay.
Redwing fell to a horror.
Okay, yeah. It's kind of going through...
It's a lovely tale.
Asante was fascinated with the younger races.
Mm-hmm.
And despite being told that the Scython Mountains were the domain of Thermael, she kind of got involved with the dwarfs there, had a little bit of loose lips and told the dwarfs about Redwing's lair, and the dwarfs went after the lair, and Redwing dealt with them handily. That's fine.
Yeah.
But the news of the lair didn't die with them. It led to repeated attempts by various adepts to liberate the treasures from Redwing's lair, which made Thermael kind of get upset because all of these dwarves in her area were getting all uppity.
Yep.
And Asante got banished as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
You did some wrong. Go away.
Yeah.
Banished to the eastern spur of the Kokhavik Mountains. So kind of on the edge of Barsave, kind of away from everything.
Yeah.
This was before she was an adult.
Mm-hmm.
She got banished before then, and kind of went through her adolescence and transformation into adulthood alone and isolated. yeah. from the rest of Dragon Society, which I think even more strengthens, in a sense, her connection with other Namegiver races.
Yes.
She didn't have quite the extent of schooling in the Dragon Society mm-hmm. that that others did. You know, she did apologize after and was accepted back into Dragon Society upon becoming an adult.
But Vastandas...
But was told, don't deal with the Scythe and Dwarves anymore. You are strictly forbidden from dealing with them in any way at all.
And that came from Vastandas.
Well, because at that point, Thermael had passed. Thermael had been mm-hmm. killed by one of the forebears of the Iopos clan.
Yeah.
And Asante followed that structure for a little bit, but eventually couldn't help herself and got involved in the affairs of the rites of protection and passage and struggles between the Therans and the dragons and so forth mm-hmm. before the Scourge.
Yeah. So because of Redwing's death, falling to a horror, and her banishment, banishment essentially, by the Dragon Council, and Vastandas forbidding her from doing anything else with the Scythen, people, she has this slight anger and resentment toward great dragons since before the Scourge. So she's had this grudge, essentially, for the last 400, 500 years, where because she was not in her adulthood, you know, in her adolescence, brought up under dragon rules, and I do mean that as, you know, the structure, not ruling with an iron fist, not brought up by dragon rules in dragon culture, she's more independent. She had to do things for herself and find things out for herself. She wasn't told or instructed by the other dragons as to what was going on or how to do things or why things are the way they are. So she has this resentment toward the Dragon Council that's been lasting for, you know, since before the Scourge. And she has this independent nature to herself as well. And so when Night Sky comes along, they...
So there's even more... Before we get to Night Sky, there is even more that highlights the story and provides insights into the personality of Asante.
Hit it.
And that is Vastandas wanted. So there's this whole thing that happened with the dragons and the dwarfs of Scytha and the Therans in terms of like a struggle over the rites of protection and so forth.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. It's just
Redwing learned that Asante went and was messing around with the dwarfs again. And flew to tell Vastandas that she had broken the rule and went to find Asante and so forth. And Redwing was attacked by the horror, a horror that, according to what the Outcast tells us, has never been heard of attacking anywhere else. And what its interest it had in Scytha and whether it might still be there are open questions. We don't know, but we do know that it was powerful enough to kill a great dragon.
Yeah.
It killed Redwing.
Yeah.
And also, as a sidebar, he said, by the way, remember that these three dragons were the ones that the Therans attacked. Yucatol was Yucatol, the third.
Yeah. Yes, because we had asked that question a couple of weeks ago. We're like, who was the third? We can't think of it.
Who was the third one?
Yeah.
Yucatol.
It was Cloud Tamer, anyway, Yucatol, and Icewing.
The dwarves of Scytha attacked Vastandas, and Asante went to Vastandas and said, look, I know that I wasn't supposed to help them out, but I care for them. Can you please help me in terms of making them safe? And Vastandas was like, no, they attacked me. They can die. I don't care what happens to them. And Asante was like, but my dwarves, oh, no, okay. And at that point, because the Scourge was fast approaching, a whole bunch of dwarves fled Scytha for Thrall. And then a whole bunch of other ones fled for the Kokovic Mountains in the area where Asante had her lair.
Mm-hmm.
And Asante was like, I will help them prepare and maybe shelter them through the Scourge,
mm-hmm.
because I like them. They're cool. And
yeah,
they're my friends and I don't want them to die. And then Vastandas came to her and said, oh, we made a deal with the Therans. We're not helping anybody out. Go. Was it Vastandas or was it Mountain Shadow? It's Mountain Shadow.
Yeah.
Mountain Shadow shows them and says, we made a deal with the Therans. We are not going to be involved. We're going to let them do their thing. You broke the rules. Go to your room. And basically sent her to her lair early.
Uh-huh.
She was like, oh, and she went to her lair and was upset, and the dwarfs that she was hoping to help didn't help and probably all died.
And didn't get help.
Didn't get help. And so she spent the Scourge in her lair, angry and upset and railing at the injustice of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a classic. Here's a great example of how, despite in some ways how noble and good some of the dragons may appear, Vazenjas, Mountain Shadow.
Yeah.
There's still some really effed up things going on with their society that, like, no, here are the rules. You listen to us.
Yeah.
And a
these
dragon
things
who
are
was,
still beneath us. That whole culture you're looking to befriend is still beneath us. What
well, it's not. It's
them.
Not yeah. even necessarily that it's beneath us. It's mm-hmm. that the rules of dragon culture.
Yeah.
Stated that the dwarves of Scytha, because they were in the Scythian Mountains, which was Vazenjas's mm-hmm. territory, it is ultimately up to him how they get dealt with. And his yeah. reaction was, they attacked me, they can go hang. I don't yeah. care. You can't get involved. Like, it's not your territory. You can't get involved with them.
Yeah.
And until, like, the opportunity came up, oh, there are some that are sort of in my territory near my lair. Great. And then, oh, well, we made the deal with Therons because they killed a couple of us and then we killed a bunch of them. And, like, we've made this deal where they can do their protections. We'll do our thing. It must be especially galling for Asante to have gotten that instruction from Mountain Shadow,
yes.
who, as we talked about many episodes ago, mm-hmm. sheltered a whole bunch of name givers in his lair and area.
Yes.
He did what she wanted to do, but he told her that she couldn't.
Yes.
He basically imposed a punishment that resulted in the deaths of people that she cared about.
Yeah. Not for you. You're too young. Something like that.
Yeah. And so she emerged from her lair after the scourge and all the dwarfs were dead. And she was mm-hmm. like, understandably, I think, royally pissed off at the injustice of it all.
Yes.
And in fact, went and tried to attack one of the villages that was under Mountain Shadow's protection, according to the outcast.
Outcast. Yeah.
She feels guilty. She's pissed off that she was prevented from doing what she wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now we come to the two of them together. We come yeah. to Asante and Night Sky, both of whom are young dragons and have personal histories that mm-hmm. motivate them greatly
yes.
to be angry and frustrated and upset at the way that their lives have been shaped by events mm-hmm. in Night Sky's case, kind of beyond his control. And in Asante's case, by the injustices of her elders.
Yeah.
And they find this kind of common cause in their anger and frustration at things. And the outcast is just like, sitting there like Emperor Palpatine, just like, yes,
we can work with
this. Let the anger flow through you. Yes, my offspring, these are dragons that you may be able to turn to your cause as we try
exactly.
and wreck the lives of the other great dragons in Barsave, because yeah. they're pissed off at them too.
Yes, like I said, this is a fantastic set of characters that are just ripe and fruitful for anything you want to do with them, because as a mated pair, they have their own lair now, and they have set aside part of the valley to harbor horror-scarred people, name givers. So Asante has this little soft spot, and because, you know, the horror took Redwing down, she's got this soft spot for anybody else who's been affected by horrors, and so they have this.
Yeah, especially in the wake of the ones of the Scythian dwarves that she was trying to help.
Yes.
And not being able to help them. That this is her way of
atonement.
Assuaging her guilt at
yeah.
her inability to help them. Not that it was necessarily something that she could completely control.
No.
But she still feels guilty over what happened and so is doing what she can to help. There's a nobility there
mm-hmm.
and a goodness.
Yes.
You know, I often talk about how dragons aren't nice, but there's this humanity, there's this empathy that is present there that we don't see to the same extent in some of the older dragons. And I wonder, we've talked about this with Mountain Shadow in the past. Mountain Shadow as a character, as a personality, develops quite a lot between the Earthdawn era and the Shadowrun era.
Yes.
And I wonder about the possibility of what went on, what goes on mm-hmm. maybe in the future with Asante and Night Sky, maybe to a lesser extent, but maybe more with yeah. Asante about mm-hmm. how he views the younger races, about how he views other name givers and their potential and what the dragon's responsibility to them is.
Yeah, maybe he's taking the lesson from her. He's learning from her, possibly her example in doing so.
That's certainly a possibility.
Yeah.
The pair are kind of starting to build their own network of allies and supporters. Mm-hmm. One of the independent trading companies out of Thrall, the Dreamspire Company, is heavily associated with them. There's an adventuring group that also kind of works with them. So they're kind of starting to build their own power base and network of name givers that can kind of gather information from them. And their location there in the eastern Kokovik Mountains puts them really close to the common routes that travel from Barsave up to Haven and Parlaenth. And yes. So it puts them into a very interesting position there as far as that goes.
Yeah, they kind of control that route because the Dreams Power Company is the only one who's not going to get attacked by a dragon you're shipping goods back and forth there. So they...
For the best airship route through.
Totally. Yeah. And so they've got this little corner of the market, the little corner of the map of Barsave on trading. And of course, they get their cut. So this is how I think Asante and Night Sky are also building their own wealth in their lair as they get a slice of whatever is going on with this business. And then, as you said, they have the Seven of Thestonius to spread their tales and increase their legend of the mated dragon pair. And, you know, that's their propaganda machine. That's their good news piece.
And the Dreamspire Company is taking advantage of Night Sky's knowledge from Night Sky's travels, extensive travels in the early days after the Scourge, to be able to open up trade routes to other areas. That's something that, hey, we've got a Vasgothia book on the way. If you're looking for a way to, like, maybe connect Barsavian adventures to Vasgothia.
Oh, yeah.
The Dreamspire Company and gaining information on safe ways to travel, because you've got the wastes kind of in the way, safe ways to navigate the hazardous journey between Barsave and Vasgothia.
Yeah.
Whether you swing south and kind of get closer to Thera, Great Thera proper, or whether you swing north and end up needing to deal with the Western Kingdoms with Sariatha.
Mm-hmm.
The other parts of that, look at the Elven Nations book for more information there. That's one possibility if you're looking for a kind of more globe-spanning type of travel adventure thing.
Yeah.
There's one last thing
that is of great
interest here, which is like so typical, but it also has the thing that has Mountain Shadow going, this is a big deal.
If it's true.
This is a huge deal.
Yes.
And we need to figure out how to deal with this. And I think Mountain Shadow has some wisdom here.
Mm-hmm.
Because the outcast mentions that Asante has laid her first clutch of eggs and has not given them to any of the great dragons the way that they're supposed to.
Well, she's laid two. It's rumored she's got three eggs. They know of two because one. One went to Earthroot, who, by the way, took in Night Sky. So that's why, you know, one went to Earthroot. And the second went to Aban in the Mist Swamps. Just because. But the third, it's a rumored third egg, was intended to go to Usun, but they also suspect that perhaps, to break with tradition, Asante is raising this egg by herself, or at least with her and Night Sky by themselves, which is never been done before. That's completely breaking with dragon tradition. Just have a great dragon raise them instead. So you're having...
And that it's basically Asante's way of saying, hey, I'm going to exert some degree of control over my life.
Yep.
In a way that I have not been able to before. By having given away a couple, perhaps reduces the possibility that there will be interest in the third. We're talking about a pair of young adult dragons that are like bucking draconic traditions in so many ways. They're living together. They're a mated pair, ostensibly for life.
Yeah.
Dragons don't normally do that.
Nope.
The dragons will mate, and then one dragon will go off to their place, and one dragon will go off to their place.
See ya. Yeah.
Then the eggs get given away to the great dragons to raise and bring up in accordance with dragon traditions.
Yes.
They're living together. They're mated for life, presumably. Mm-hmm. They certainly have a very strong emotional
commitment
bond.
To one another. Yeah.
possibly keeping one of her eggs herself.
Yeah.
And this is another case where the outcast is like, there is so much that we could do to mess with
the
great dragons, to mess with my siblings, my erstwhile colleagues, the other great dragons of Barsave, who, as you know, are a bunch of hypocritical jerkwads and dumb and short-sighted, not like me, who is brilliant and knows exactly what's going on and not making the mistakes that they did, because look, they're making more mistakes. They're treating these dragons awfully, and that is an opportunity to win them to our side, which would be great. Or, failing that, if this third egg thing is true, we can cause all kinds of strife and discord among the dragons of Barsave, because this is a big deal, and it's going to cause all kinds of problems and distract them, which will give us the opportunity to continue to do nonsense and wreck their day. And I just like wrecking their day because I'm petty like that.
Yo, Outcast is so a narcissist. He's perfect. Everyone else is wrong. And he's just going to sit there and just play with everybody.
There's so much you could do. You could take the egg yourselves. You could deliver it to the Therans. You could deliver it to the Cult of the Great Hunter. You could, this egg is not going to be as well protected as it would normally be because it's not in the lair of a great dragon.
Of a great dragon, just an adult one.
If it goes missing, Asante is going to freak the fuck out.
Yes.
And not be able to go to the other great dragons for help because she knows she'll be in deep trouble if she does, because the other dragons are going to be pissed that she didn't do what she said she was, like, what she's supposed to do.
Yeah.
It's like a great soap opera, and I can't wait to see what kind of chaos I can wreak by letting this go.
Totally.
I mean, this whole thing about Asante and Night Sky is nothing but plot hook after plot hook after, like, groundwork being laid for whatever kind of stuff that you want to have going on.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is a situation where you are not, there's a lot that you could do with this.
So where do you start with this? Because
where do you start?
Throw a dart into this mess and you can have some kind of plot hook to engage a whole party with them.
Oh, hey, we could frame people, make it look like Thrall stole the egg. This is basically, when you start getting into journeyman upper tier stuff, because if you're dealing with pissed off dragons or having lower circle characters that somehow get involved peripherally with this and end up being owed a favor by an adult dragon or a pair of adult dragons.
Exactly. I mean, because this egg isn't due to hatch for 80, 90 years or so, because they take 100 years or so to actually hatch. And so we don't know how old this egg is, but it obviously is not due to hatch anytime soon. But still, that's just, transporting an egg. I mean, just imagine that storyline right there. And if you get involved at all with the Dreamspire company and you're going to back and forth from Parlaenth or Haven to Thrall, that's the best route you got to take. So no matter what, you're already in their purview.
One quick footnote to wrap this up. In his final commentary and his response to this whole egg thing.
Yeah.
Mountain Shadow does say that, yes, there were three eggs, but the third went to Usoon.
Yes.
Or the third was supposed to go to Usoon.
Uh-huh.
Let's make sure that that's what actually happened.
Yeah.
Again, another example, similar where we talked a couple of weeks ago, the outcast can actually be wrong. His information is not perfect.
It's not
he is capable of making mistakes. But the implication, regardless, I just love the barely concealed glee that you can get from the outcast's essay in here about, look at these kids. These kids are going to mess everything up. And it's awesome because them messing things up makes things easier for me.
Yeah.
And we can nudge things to make them mess it up.
Yeah.
Or maybe win them over to our side. I don't see any, the outcast at this point is not seeing a lose situation for himself in this.
No, no.
Maybe they don't join us, but even if they don't, they're going to cause all kinds of other problems that are just going to be glorious chaos for us to continue to operate under the dragon's noses, which is great.
This, like I said, this is
all groundwork and future plot laying.
Oh, totally.
It's amazing. Now, okay, we got to wrap up.
Well, I could see the novel being written about just Asante and Night Sky. I really could.
Asante and Night Sky do appear in the 4th edition GM's Guide.
Yep.
With stat blocks. I don't recall now off the top of my head. So the information on Asante and Night Sky that is in the 4th edition book does not get into the whole egg thing and outcast stuff. It's more just kind of providing basic psychological backgrounds and information about the dragons. It doesn't get into the whole Scython situation with Asante.
No.
You know, it does talk about her fondness for the younger races, but it doesn't really get into her whole history and everything. They are sort of both presented there, but there's a lot going on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. So if you have any questions for us, A, about how long we could have run on this one before we had decided that we really need to wrap this one up. B, if you have any questions for us at all about anything in general, you've obviously heard the first part of the podcast where we talked about and answered any kind of question that came in. And C, if you have any questions about the dragons, Asante, Night Sky, or anything we've other any other dragon we've talked about before or what we're going to talk about next, feel free to email us at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. Josh, any final thoughts before I say goodnight?
As of the drop time of this episode, you've got a little bit over 48 hours left in the Vasgothia Kickstarter.
So go get it if you want it. If you don't want it, it'll still be for sale later on, but it'll be a little
This is not like Kickstarter exclusive. There will still be the opportunity to get the book later. But if you want to get early access to the pre-release draft, you better back the book because we'll be releasing that hopefully within just a couple of days of the Kickstarter actually closing and making that available to backers.
And the add-on books are a little bit cheaper during a Kickstarter than they are normally priced at the store.
Yeah, well, mainly because while you pay cover price, like the standard cover price for the print books, you get the PDFs thrown in at no extra charge, whereas normally there's a bundle rate that charges a little bit extra if you order the print and PDF combo through our website.
Yeah. So until next time, folks, it is time for you to go rebel against the tradition of your legend.
Good night, everybody.